Meteorologist Chris McGinnis.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen,
you ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday, and it's a pleasure to be with you. It's honestly provocative talk, and you're welcome to join the conversation. And this one is a bit of a barn burner. I know it's going to be a familiar issue. It is Medicaid and illegal aliens, but now there is something new. The attorneys general of 20 different states, and you know the states I'm talking about, the blue states, have decided to bring a suit. And what they're claiming in their lawsuit is that the federal government is going too far in requiring that people show that they are legally in the country and that they are legally entitled to get food stamps, welfare, Medicaid, and all these other social services. Now, apparently these attorneys general didn't bother to go to law school, where they might have said, hey, before you bring that lawsuit, maybe you want to check federal law. Because federal law already says that illegal aliens, people in the country illegally, cannot get Medicaid, welfare, food stamps, Section 8, or any of the rest of that. That is in federal law. That is nothing new. It is not something invented by the evil orange man, Donald John Trump. It is in federal law. So what have those 20 states been doing? They've been violating the law. Well, they found a clever way around it, a way that only an attorney working on billable hours would actually appreciate. Because what they decided to do was they said, well, federal law says we can't give Medicaid and welfare and all the other goodies to people who are in the country legally, illegally. So who can we give them to? Well, we can give any of those services to American citizens. We can also give them to green card holding legal aliens, but they aren't likely to need it anyway. And the reason I say that is that federal law already says if you want to apply to emigrate to the United States, get a green card to so you can work a job, stay here for 5 years, keep your nose clean, don't break any of the laws of the United States. Why, in 5 years, you too can become an American citizen. So why aren't they likely to need it? Because one of the tests they apply to anybody applying for a green card is they say, you need to show us that you are unlikely to become what the law calls a public charge. Now, you don't even have to be an attorney to understand what a public charge is. What a public charge is the way federal law says you are unlikely to become, say, dependent on welfare, food stamps, Medicaid, or any of the other social services. And I would think that if you put that one to a vote, most Americans would say, are you in favor of immigration? Absolutely, and so am I. Okay, do you want to have people emigrate here who are not capable of supporting themselves and their family? No, not exactly. I mean, that's like inviting your deadbeat brother-in-law to come and live at your house and eat out of your refrigerator and watch your cable TV and use your internet while he sits on the couch and does not look for a job. I hope if I'm cutting a little too close to home for some folks that you'll forgive me for that. But that's what it's like. If your wife says, well, can't John come and stay at our house for just a few weeks? Why? So he can sit on my couch and drink my beer and watch my big screen TV and play video games and not look for a job here? No, he can go somewhere else. It's not that you're being uncharitable. It's not that you're being unchristian. It's not that you're not reflecting your family. You know your family. If you don't want your deadbeat brother-in-law living at your house essentially forever, you say he can come here if he is finding a job, getting a job, and eventually finding his own place to live. That's effectively what federal law says that we're supposed to say to everybody who wants to immigrate to America legally. Well, what's happened in the last 4 years? Because of demented Joe Biden and whichever member of his staff happened to be operating the auto pen for the last 4 years, Joe Biden decided to invite 10 million plus illegal aliens to come to America and stay. including, of course, a few hundred thousand children that the Joe Biden administration lost track of. Donald Trump now has the job of trying to find all those kids. But when Joe Biden invited them in, he said, we're going to give you humanitarian parole. Now, that was supposed to be given on a case-by-case basis. Biden just said, give it to everyone. So literally millions of people were signed off. You are now eligible for all the freebies that America offers. Well, now that they've signed up for those freebies over the last 4 years, now you've got a bunch of dimwit attorneys general from California, Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, other liberal states that have all said, well, we're going to go to court. We say the federal government is going too far by actually holding the system to the laws that have been on the books for decades. The Democrat attorneys general are saying these new rules, why they threaten the Head Start program for children five and younger. Now, what if you're one of those parents who happens to be a legal resident of the United States or a citizen, and you've gone down saying, I want to get my kids signed up for Head Start. I'm sorry, there aren't enough spaces. Joe Biden filled them all with the children of illegal aliens. They're worried about Title IX family planning and adult education and mental health and substance abuse programs and community health shelters and shelters for at-risk youth and domestic violence survivors. So you've got all these people who are Americans who are entitled to those services, and they're being given away to illegal aliens. And now you've got the attorneys general who are going to spend your tax money suing your federal government, demanding that the federal government actually fund this. The lawsuit says that hungry individuals were never required before to show a government-issued ID to enter a soup kitchen or a food bank. Well, if you're a private food bank, you can set whatever rules you want. If you're a soup kitchen and you're private, you can do whatever you want. But if you're taking federal money, and sadly, many of those charities are doing just that, they're taking federal money. So at that point, if Donald Trump says, let's make sure that all these services that cost tens of billions of dollars a year and all of that paid for by the taxpayers, let's make sure that all the services they provide are going only to those who are legally entitled to receive them. Except the Democrat attorney generals don't like it. They've said they are more concerned about the welfare of illegal aliens than they are the welfare and the well-being of the people from their own states. Now, ask yourself, did you elect that attorney general in your state and say, I don't want you to care about my family or my community. I want you to be concerned about all the illegal aliens that Joe Biden invited to invade this country. Do you know anybody who is that liberal? I mean, I might actually get a naysayer or two today who says, yeah, I want to talk about how we ought to take all the things that Americans have, take them away from those Americans, tell them there's no room in the Head Start program for your kid or your grandchild because we've given all those slots away. There's no more Medicaid for you, because we're going to shortchange the hospitals and the doctors so we make sure that we take care of Joe Biden's 10 million illegal aliens. If anybody is that much of an naysayer, I'd love to hear them make that argument. In fact, I'd love it if we could actually put it to a vote. How many Americans who pay too much of their salary in taxes to the federal government want all that it buys to be given away to somebody other than the people who are in their community? Glad to be with you on a Tuesday. Always glad to take your calls for some honestly provocative talk. 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network, serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Summer is.
Donald Trump with a warning to Hamas at the Republican Jewish Coalition Conference.
If you spill a drop of American blood, we will spill a gallon of yours.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense? sense.
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, you know what drives most liberals absolutely crazy? When Donald Trump keeps his promises. 6 months in, consider where we stand. Seal the border, got that done so well that the cartel news media types don't talk about it very much anymore, other than whining about the harsh conditions at Alligator Alcatraz in Florida. Gang members from groups like Tren de Aragua deported, imprisoned, or on the run. Core inflation now stands at its lowest level in 4 years. Gas prices also their lowest level in 4 years. Donald Trump's America First agenda has dozens of companies, literally dozens of them, announcing trillions in new American investment. That brings home jobs that were driven overseas by the crazy policies mostly of the federal government. Medicaid, the taxpayer-funded health insurance for the poor, will not be going to doctors who sexually mutilate teenagers, will not be going to illegal aliens, and won't be going to deadbeat Americans who refuse to get a job. Tax cuts from 8 years ago that mean thousands of dollars to the average working family. Tax cuts that were on the schedule to expire at the end of this year are preserved in the big, beautiful bill. Conventional wisdom holds you can never believe promises from politicians. Donald Trump keeps his word. He may be changing that assumption. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Get better fast. Multnomah Medical Clinic. Well, why did convicted killer Brian Koberger kill those four Idaho college students? From the Boise Statesman, President Trump on Monday, just days before Koberger is scheduled to be sentenced, weighed in on the plea deal that allows the 30-year-old man, murderer, to avoid the death penalty for killing four University of Idaho students in their home in Moscow. There were vicious murders. There were so many questions left unanswered. While life imprisonment is tough, it's certainly better than receiving the death penalty. But before sentencing, I hope the judge makes Koberger, at a minimum, explain why he did these horrible murders. My favorite post on X today, although it was about some sad news, Ozzy Osbourne has passed away at the age of 76, just days after he gave his final performance. Ozzy's working with his therapist every single day. That's what his wife Sharon had said shortly before he passed away. Ozzy's number one thing in life is his fans. He's working hard to be ready for them and to make the show the perfect way to end things. It was his final show in so many ways. And rest in peace. Despite any controversy you might believe about Ozzy Osbourne, I don't know the guy, but I admired his musical talents. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
I want to give today's Daily Grill to most of the cartel media in the Portland metro area, and let me tell you why. They're almost all running a headline that reads almost identically, which is a little bit disturbing when different news organizations come up with the same sentence. Hillsboro man sentenced to life for shooting and killing teenager and injuring another in 2023. Now, when you say sentenced to life, that carries a meaning. It means you're sending him to prison for the rest of his life. The problem with that is, if you dig deep enough into the story, you find this. Juvenile justice reforms, when they softened up Measure 11, allow Cuellar Torres to be eligible for parole after 15 years and conditional release after serving half of his sentence. So you've got headlines that say he's going to prison for life for murdering one person and seriously wounding a second person, a teenager, when in fact he's not going to prison for life. He will likely walk out the door before his 40th birthday. Do you think it's honest to tell your audience that you're sending a man to prison for life when in fact you know it is far from life? He will walk out with roughly half his life still to be lived outside of custody. Today's best email, you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com, is brought to you by Cap Concrete Coatings. Turn your garage, patio, or driveway from ugly and rough to beautiful and tough. They did it for me, and the result is beautiful, I can tell you. Check out CapConcreteCoatings.com or 855-CAP-THAT. That's 855-CAP-THAT. Greg writes in from Milan, Washington. out here in North Central Washington, fuel is going to be $5 for diesel in a week or so. Gas not far behind. Even as the price goes down nationally on average, the commie states are still going to screw their citizens. As fuel goes up, so does the cost of everything else. I know you've pointed it out hundreds of times. This uncontrolled spending to distribute to get votes and give money to the party's supporters. It's exactly why the founders despised a democracy, or more correctly, mob rule. These evil politicians are too stupid to know this is exactly what caused the American Revolution. Signed, Greg. Greg, I have to agree with you. And it's crazy. And by the way, a reminder to our friends from the Democrat Party, we are not a democracy. We are a constitutional republic. We have representative government, and thank God, because democracies always fail. Let's go to Dick in Corvallis. Hey, Dick, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, Lars, I wanted to share with your audience. So I was legally married while in the Navy overseas.
Yep.
The Navy shipped me back to the United States before I got my paperwork done. Not only did I have to provide letters from my employer stating how long I'd be employed and what kind of wages I had to make, my stepfather ended up co-signing, saying that if I lost my wages, if I lost my job, he would assume full financial support for my family.
And that's right. And that's responsible, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I personally didn't have an issue with any of that.
And yet today we're supposed to give a pass to people who came in illegally with the assistance of the Biden crime family?
Correct. That's why this illegal immigration upsets me to the point it does, because I did it legally. My wife ended up becoming a U.S. citizen.
Good.
Everything was done correctly.
Yeah, and see, that's the way to do it. What kills me is when you've got an attorney general, whether it's the attorney general of Washington or the attorney general of Oregon, who've joined in this lawsuit to say, we're going to make the federal government take your money and give it away to illegal aliens. They ought to be removed from their posts, but I don't know of a way to get that done. Not in liberal states like Oregon and Washington. Let's go to Guy. Hey, Guy, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Lars. And blessings to Dick over in Corvallis. So, yeah, I was stationed at Andrews Air Force Base in D.C. back in 80, and we wanted, a buddy of mine, we wanted to go to Australia. And we went to the Australian embassy.
Yep.
Yes, and just to see what we could do when we took leave. And they said, well, you're going to have somebody to sponsor you, or you got to have X amount of money and everything else. And that wouldn't work. And I just thought, well, my God, you know, and I started thinking, well, we had Ellis Island where you had to come in and they looked you over, make sure you were physically fit and stuff. What do you have? Who's going to sponsor you if you don't have money and stuff? And if you didn't have it, they take you back.
That's right. And if you were sick, they sent you back. Obviously, the rules changed a bit under Joe Biden. Guy, thanks for the call. It's Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show. Some solid advice from Senator John Kennedy.
Look, if you hate cops just because of the cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. You know, the Northwest is sitting on a gold mine of timber. And the great irony is that while we sit here with all these trees surrounding us, we've got a country where 28%, more than a quarter, less than a third, of all the lumber that comes into this country comes from mostly Canada, but foreign countries in general. And you wonder, why would people with hundreds of millions of acres of trees have to import lumber from anywhere, like importing ice into Alaska or something, or oil into Saudi Arabia is one I've used before, too. So there was the good news a few months ago when President Trump said, we are going to dramatically increase the logging on America's forests, which should be celebrated by everyone. But the tree huggers out there don't like it. And the Forest Service, maybe not getting with the program. So then in the big, beautiful bill that became law on the 4th of July, came the news that they were going to do some changes with the way that forest sales are done from the federal government. It used to be that maybe you'd get you'd buy a lease to be able to cut the timber, and it would last for 5 years, and then it would go away. Now they've extended those, and that could be a game changer for bringing mills and logging and sawmills back to the Pacific Northwest and take advantage of this great public resource to benefit both the people who work in the industry and, of course, the American Treasury as well. Well, Heath Heikkilä joins me now, who's the American Forest Resource Council's Government Affairs Director. Heath, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me, Lars.
Hey, I take it that there are some people who like this change, and there are others who don't, and then we can talk about the funding of the Forest Service, which is another piece of the big, beautiful bill. I want to get your take on it first, though.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks. Well, you know, the Forest Service now has long-term contracts. They do have that authority. And really the biggest hang-up for the management of federal forests is not so much the contract length as it is the process and litigation that the Forest Service has to face to be able to put up a timber sale. Whether that timber sale or forest management project is going to last 5 years or 10 years, that is the biggest hang-up we have right now.
Because if you're running a sawmill and you say, I can't run this sawmill, I can't improve this sawmill if I don't have a steady stream of timber. So it can't be, well, you'll get timber this year, but next year's a question mark. Nobody's going to invest any great amount of money into preserving something like a sawmill or a logging operation if they don't know they've got a long-term supply of the product. Do I understand that right?
You have it 100% right, and that's the problem we have in the West, where a heavy portion of our forests are owned by the federal government. Oregon's one of the best examples. 60% of Oregon's forests are owned by the federal government, and just frankly, over the last 2 to 3 decades, we've seen drastic reductions in harvest levels on federal lands. We're talking in the magnitude of 80 to 90%. So it is very hard to go out and make an investment in an existing mill, let alone bring a mill to a place that needs it for forest health purposes, thinning of forests without, frankly, a stable supply of timber from the Forest Service.
Well, Heath, let me try a metaphor on you. I mean, I said to somebody the other day, I said, imagine you're a guy or gal who works in the trades. You work in construction. And somebody comes to you and says, hey, I got a great job for you this month, but I need you to buy about $20,000 worth of tools that you don't have right now. And you say, okay, great. I go out and spend 20 grand on tools and you have work for me for a month. How about after that? They say, well, after that, who knows? Are you going to go out and drop 20 grand on new tools to work for a month? I mean, if the employer says, I've got work for you for the next 5 years, it might not be, it's a no-brainer. You say, sure, I'll buy the tools if you're going to put me to work for 5 years. But if you put me to work for a month or two or, a week or two, I'm not going to go out and make that investment. Nobody would do that, would they?
No, they would not. Not anyone who probably had any kind of business sense would not do that. And, you know, the hard part is that a lot of our member mills are located in rural communities where they're heavily dependent on the jobs that come from the forest sector. So these people are invested in these communities. They tend to stay there longer than maybe another business would because they're so invested in the community. But we really need the federal government to step up and to increase common sense management, active management of these federal forests.
Well, and in fact, I went to a high school in Tillamook. It was literally right across the street from a major sawmill. And it wasn't just, the people from the community, but even the high school kids would get good jobs doing that. The second piece of this is the piece about the funding for the Forest Service. Because right now, the timber cut, when they cut timber, they get, severance. They get the money that comes to that to the federal government. It goes to the Forest Service. And they lose money every year. I mean, it sounds like they're run by idiots, and maybe you don't want to get yourself in bad odor with the Forest Service, but, when you say you got 200 million acres of trees, can you manage to lose money with that? Well, they do. And because their money comes to them from the cut of the trees, the big, beautiful bill, if I understand it right, says no, now the money goes to the Treasury, and the Forest Service can then go to the Congress and say, we need our budget. And I think the Congress could legitimately look at them and say, how much do you need? I don't remember what the Forest Service budget is. Say it's $5 billion. Okay, we'll give you $5 billion. How much are you going to bring back in cut timber? And they say, $3 billion. You say, so you're going to lose $2 billion for us. You're not getting your budget. Or you need to increase your cut so that at least you're a break-even operation. Can that happen now after the big, beautiful bill?
Well, you know, actually, I would argue, Lars, that if you go back 30 years ago, what we were doing in the Pacific Northwest was much more like you're saying now, where we were harvesting very high-value timberlands. The Forest Service was generating revenue, and they were keeping a lot of that revenue, actually, to go out and build roads, invest in campgrounds, do things like that on the forest, not to mention we were helping to provide funding to counties. Counties cannot tax Forest Service land, so those revenue sharing was the replacement for that. But in about 2000, after the Spotted Owl and the Northwest Forest Plan, we actually really disconnected counties and the Forest Service from the revenue they generate, frankly. So what's been going on is the Forest Service has been largely living off of appropriations that it gets from Congress, really with no connection to the revenue it generates. In fact, its revenues continue to go down. So what the Big Beautiful Bill does in a couple areas, one is it mandates increased harvest levels. That is absolutely critical to try to get this pendulum back to the middle. It also included these long-term contracts that you mentioned earlier. That can be an important tool used in the right places. There has been some concern that it would take all the revenue from those long-term contracts and send it to the U.S. Treasury. And that, in fact, kind of perpetuates this disconnect between the Forest Service and the revenue that it's generating, in our view.
I'm talking to Keith Heikkilä, who is the Government Affairs Director at American Forest Resource. We're going to hit a bump here or a break here in a second. Would you mind sticking around for a second segment with me, or are you up against the clock?
No, I'd be happy to.
Okay, because when we come back, here's what I want to ask you about. About 2 weeks ago, I talked to the regional manager for the BLM. And the first disturbing thing he told me was, well, I'm not actually a forester. So when I started asking him questions about, well, how much could we log? Could we log more than we're logging now? He said, well, we just cut what we're allowed to cut, and that's all we do. As though, you know, it's a set of rules, and this is what you do, and this is what you're allowed to cut. And what really stunned me was when the guy said, we cut what we're allowed to cut. And I said, well, how much are you allowed to cut this year? Reasonable question. He said 350 million board feet. And I said, well, how many are you going to cut? He said, 250. I said, so you're leaving 100 million board feet of trees standing there that might have created 800 to 1,000 jobs in just one region of the BLM? He said, yep. I said, well, do you know how much you could be cutting and never run out of trees? Sustained yield is what they call it. And he said, nope, I'm not a forester, so I really don't know. It's almost as though I was talking to Ketanji Brown Jackson's brother or something. Keith, I want to hold you through to that second segment because I'm curious. In the Northwest, do people actually care if the federal government just continues to lose money on a rich resource like the forest? And that matters not just to people in the Northwest, but to every American taxpayer. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. If you
Constantine Kissin on Hamas.
For years now, many of us have been warning that the barbarians are at the gates. We were wrong. They're inside. There are positives as well. I mean, say what you want about Hamas supporters, at least they know what a woman is.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I don't do this often, but Heath Heikkilä has joined me from the American Forest Resource Council. So, Heath, you heard about, I told you about the conversation I had with that BLM regional manager who said, I don't know how much we could cut if we wanted to. I just know that we cut what we're allowed to cut. And then he admitted to me that they were only cutting 2/3 of the trees, leaving 800 to 1,000 jobs that could have been had for one region of the BLM. Is that repeating itself throughout the United States? Is that common that the federal agencies aren't even cutting the trees they could be cutting, and that denies the region jobs and the Treasury income?
Oh, absolutely, Lars. And we're not only not cutting the trees that could create jobs and economic activity, we're not cutting the trees that need to come out to reduce wildfire risk. We're not cutting trees.
Oh, I was going to get to that next. But
yeah, after they burn in mega fires. So, you know, your O&C lands there in Oregon are a great example. Those lands grow about 1.2 billion board feet of timber every year. They're harvesting a little over, they're selling a little over 200 million board feet. So very small amounts, and part of the reason is because they say they don't have enough funding, and that kind of goes back to our previous conversation about trying to reconnect these agencies, the revenue they generate, to the revenue that they then need to pay their operations and so forth.
Well, are they saying that they don't have the funding because they anticipate that to actually lease or sell the timber off the land, they're going to have to go through a multi-year legal fight to be able to do it?
Yeah, there are so many hoops that our federal land managers, these are foresters, biologists, they're trained professionals, have to jump through to be able to do a single timber sale. It takes years. It often can take a mountain of paperwork, not to mention then going into court. In recent testimony, the deputy chief of the Forest Service actually commented that in regions where they face extensive litigation, the Forest Service's costs are doubled. So that is a huge limiter on being able to do good forestry work out in the woods.
So as a result, we end up with forests that, instead of being cut, are tied up in red tape, and then they burn to the ground. Am I overstating that?
You are not overstating that. And 2020's Labor Day fires in Oregon were a prime example. You can't help but look what happened every summer in California. And unfortunately, folks, we are getting warmer and drier, and we are going to face this more and more. That's why we need to take a proactive approach to responsibly managing these lands.
Is there a way to cut all that red tape, and can Trump do it, or will it have to be the Congress that changes the laws?
Well, Trump is trying to do some streamlining of some of the, I'll call it the hoops that the agency itself created for itself. And so he is working on doing that, and I think there will be some progress. There was also some good decisions recently out of the U.S. Supreme Court that will help kind of hopefully address some of the paperwork requirements. But ultimately, if we want to see meaningful change to the management of these federal lands, Congress is going to have to act. And probably in a bipartisan way, because you need 60 votes to get things through the United States Senate.
Okay, so we kind of started with the idea the Forest Service and the BLM routinely lose money every year. They don't harvest as much timber as it even costs to pay their expenses. But you just told me they could be harvesting about five times as much timber and literally never run out of trees, because you cut them, you replant them, and 50 years later you have a mature tree. We could be cutting five times as much lumber and still be at sustained yield.
I mean, under the technical definition of sustained yield, of course, there are, you know, a lot of overlays on our federal land as it relates to endangered species and so forth. So, you know, but there is no doubt that we could easily double or triple harvest in the Pacific Northwest, and we still wouldn't even be close to where we were in the 70s and 80s.
Okay, and so, and the result of that would be thousands of additional jobs to the region and a lot of money, I don't know how much, going into the U.S. Treasury.
Well, it'd be billions
or
going into, you know, millions, you know, hundreds of millions going to counties to fund libraries. A place like Josephine County that has like, what, one sheriff covering hundreds of miles of territory, helping to fund the things that the timber once supported. And then, yeah, putting money back into the treasury. And then hopefully through some of these trust funds and other ways they have to do it, helping to pay for the management costs at the Forest Service to hopefully retie, you know, their management to economics, which has been disconnected for two decades.
Well, I'm just glad to see Trump doing what he's doing right now to say we're going to harvest more. And at the very least, I'd love it if they'd go to people like that BLM manager I talked to a couple of weeks ago. And remember, he's not one of the guys down on the floor, you know, cruising timber or cutting trees down with a chainsaw. He's a manager of an entire region. And he had to admit, yeah, we're only cutting about two-thirds of what we're allowed to cut. And I assume the rest is going to be left there so that it'll either catch fire and burn or be eaten by bugs or killed by disease, but certainly not doing anybody any good, not even the forest as well. Any last thing you want to tell my audience, Heath?
Yeah, just, you know, stay engaged and really, you know, weigh in with your federal officials. What we have right now is just not acceptable in terms of the status quo from an economic standpoint, an environmental standpoint. Who wants their air choked full of smoke every summer? We can do better.
Yeah, I certainly think we can. Heath, thank you very much. That's Heath Heikkilä, who is the American Forest Resource Council's Government Affairs Director. It's a Tuesday, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
Your boy.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars
and now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I always confess that I'm not a lawyer. Actually, sometimes I brag that I'm not a lawyer because I don't want to be a lawyer. And I think the world has too many lawyers in it, too many lawsuits, and too many laws and everything else. But when there's a question that comes up that requires some kind of legal interpretation, one of my favorite people to turn to is former District Attorney Josh Marquis, now with the Criminal Justice Truth Project. Josh, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. And I have to concede that, yes, I am still a practicing lawyer, although I don't live in Oregon anymore.
Okay. And I'm glad that you are willing to admit that you're a lawyer. Like I said, we could get into the question of whether or not the world has too many lawyers in it. But let me ask you about this. You've got Letitia James, the very litigious and very political attorney general of New York State, who's brought a lawsuit joined by the 20 usual suspects, all the other blue states of the United States. And they've said, we want to get the courts to stop Donald Trump from cutting off illegal aliens from social welfare benefits that the last time I read the federal law, and I have read the federal law, they're not entitled to anyway. Do you want to tell me what you think is going on there?
Well, I'm not only an unlapsed lawyer, I'm also, as you have pointed out, an unlapsed Democrat. Although the party has largely left me. There's been a trend over the last 10 or 15 years that you noted that the Office of State Attorney General, which in some states is not even partisan and shouldn't be, has been made super partisan, particularly by Democrats who have decided that it is, in fact, a highly political office. And Dan Rayfield, who's a nice enough guy, I've only met him once or twice, but, you know, you'd expect the attorney general, presumably, to be fighting drug abuse and, going after fraudsters. Well, you know, Dan Rayfield was one of the people in support of Measure 110, in making basically drugs legal. And their idea of dealing with the housing problems is to basically require everyone else to build more stick housing that the homeless refuse to live in. So in other words, they've become hyper, hyper political. And you're right, the Democratic Attorney General of New York State is sort of leads the pack in hyper politicizing. And I may not like a lot of the things that Donald Trump does, but I also don't think it's the place of the state attorney general to make their main form of litigation to be to try to frustrate what the national electors chose as the president.
Well, and not only that, but Josh, I could argue that these 20 attorneys general are actually working against the best interests of the people in their state. Because you say there are some people in every single state who need and could arguably get through their tough times with welfare, with food stamps, with Section 8, with Medicaid and all that. So it is there for them. That's what the federal law says. And now you've got attorneys general like Tish James and Dan Rayfield and other knuckleheads from around America, 20 states,
California,
all of them that are saying, hey, we want to spend a bunch of the money, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars
billions.
On people who have no right to receive these things. Well, since it's kind of a zero-sum game, if you spend money on illegal aliens, then it's money you can't spend on your own population. So these attorneys general are saying, we want to take the money, and instead of spending it on the people the law says it's supposed to benefit, we're going to spend it on people the law says it's not supposed to go to, and that's going to cost our own citizens. Could you argue that they're actually acting in a way that is detrimental to their very constituents?
I think you could. And on the one hand, you know, obviously the Attorney General of Oregon was elected not by a massive, the Republican candidate, one of the few Republicans I supported, Will Lathrop, only lost by a couple percentage points. But what is the real purpose of a state attorney general? I mean, generally speaking, and even in the history of Oregon, when we had Republicans like Dave Frohmeyer and we had Democrats like Hardy Myers, and might have had differences with both of them, but they devoted the attorney general's office to fighting for crime victims' rights or filing lawsuits against really rapacious corporations. Not this hyper-political stuff where essentially the joke is, it's a standard political joke, that the Association of Democratic Attorney Generals is also known as the aspiring governors of America, because every AG wants to be a governor, but that they are hyper-political, and you shouldn't be able to see such a huge difference in the political purposes of, say, one state versus another. And the other is, it's a limited amount of money. The federal government can print money. They can spend money. Congress can legislate. It's not a good idea for things they don't really have the gold to back it up. State governments can't do that. So what we're seeing, though, is some states' government, and Oregon is a doozy. And one of the reasons I moved out of the state was that my tax dollars were being spent and are being spent continuously for purposes that not only I don't agree with, but most Oregonians don't agree with.
Now, is there any legal remedy for that? If an attorney general says, I'm going to do things that run counter to the law and they're run counter to the best interests of my constituents, is there any legal remedy for that?
Well, there are two legal remedies. The most obvious one is the political remedy, which is you elect someone else. That opportunity only comes up every 4 years. There is technically the ability to file a lawsuit and say, but someone has to actually, once again, lawyers have to be involved. You have to find an attorney who's willing to take on a case and say, this goes so far beyond what the responsibilities of the attorney general are that this is a waste of the state's money. That is not, you know, beyond the realm of possibility, and that has happened in states. But the fact of the matter is, instead, what we're seeing are these giant political rallies. Again, rallies. I don't like a lot of the things that Donald Trump does, but I don't think the way
hold
to
on.
Address
you've
that
mentioned that
is
twice
to have
now.
The state attorney general sue him.
You've mentioned that twice now, so I'm tempted to ask you, is Donald Trump right to say welfare only goes to American citizens? Welfare only does not go to illegals. Medicaid only goes to Americans, either legal resident aliens or American citizens, and not to illegals. Is Trump wrong on that?
Some of those. Let's talk about something I agree with him on. The entry into the United States is a privilege if you're not a native-born citizen, and you just by making it across the border do not therefore entitle yourselves to all of the same benefits and protections that people that are born here. Now, it can get more complicated than that. But
no, but you're not answering the question. Does federal law right now says if you're illegally in the country, you can't get Medicaid, you can't get food stamps, you can't get welfare? So would you agree Trump is right and the attorneys general who are suing him over those three issues are wrong?
Largely he's right. It's not quite that simple as it often is. But the real question is that really what we want the state attorney generals to spend their time doing, is litigating all this other stuff? Is that the greatest problem facing America today on the state level? No. In Oregon, the problems are crime, homelessness, drugs. It'd be interesting to see what is the state attorney general of Oregon going to actually functionally do about reducing those issues.
I don't think he's doing a damn thing. He's too busy trying to be the next governor. Thanks so much, Josh. I appreciate the time. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Ronald Reagan knew better. Do you?
All of it began the first time some of you who know better and are old enough to know better let young people think that they had the right to choose the laws they would obey as long as they were doing it in the name of social protest.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Well, somewhat of a bombshell dropped over the last couple of days involving the usual suspects, Barack Hussein Obama, perhaps Joe Biden, his then vice president, and others. And why? Well, some of this is going to sound familiar because all of us, I mean, a lot of us have suspected for a long, long time that Barack Obama was not just knowledgeable about what was being done in the Russia collusion hoax that turned out to be a major hoax. And yet you had major league players like 51 intelligence officials who signed a letter saying, oh, that Hunter Biden laptop stuff, that's just garbage cooked up by the Russians. It's actually a Russian hoax. No, it was not. We know that today, and we can actually prove that today. But I guess much like they asked back during Watergate when I was a kid, what did the president know and when did he start knowing it? Well, how much did Barack Hussein Obama know about what was going on? I want to dig into that just a bit. But if you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, you're always welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you happen to be a naysayer, we're going to put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our poll on X. We put up a brand new question on X every day at Lars Larson Show and on my website at LarsLarson.com. So here is the bombshell, and it comes from the Director of National Intelligence, and that is DNI Gabbard, Tulsi Gabbard. And what Tulsi Gabbard has said is that the released now unclassified documents show overwhelming evidence, those are the words she uses, that then President Barack Obama and his national security team didn't just know about the Russia hoax, they laid the groundwork, which would be the groundwork to make the Russia hoax actually work. And what they did, it was a years-long Trump-Russia collusion probe after Donald Trump's election win against former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in 2016. Now, why did they do this? Well, it's one thing when you see a political party decide to support a candidate or oppose another candidate. That's natural. But if somebody is in the government and has the power that, say, a president does, or a vice president, or the head of the FBI, or the head of other federal agencies, the DNI released a memo saying that Obama manufactured the Russia interference. He didn't just know that Hillary Clinton was out there cooking up this deal. Now, just to refresh your memory, remember that there was a document called the Steele dossier. It was put together by a former British secret agent, Christopher Steele, and it was put together at the behest of a political organization called Fusion GPS that had, through marriage, some very tight ties with the FBI. And you say, well, why were they doing all of that? Well, Fusion GPS did it because the Democrat Party and Hillary Clinton paid Fusion millions of dollars to come up with something they could use against Donald Trump. And that Steele dossier, I read it way back when it first saw light, because most of the major media did not want to look at this thing at all. They looked at it and they said, that thing is so cockamamie, we're not going to believe it unless it's got some kind of substance behind it. So what did they do? The memo cites two intelligence reports that focused on different parts of the interference. And now President Trump is calling for Obama to be criminally prosecuted. Well, I guess turnabout is fair play, because the Democrats used lawfare against Donald Trump. And I'm constantly being reminded by naysayers to the show, well, you know, Trump is actually a convicted felon. Really? 34 felonies. I know about that. What is it he actually did? Well, you know, I'm not quite sure. Well, if you get right down to it, he wrote a check to pay for an NDA, non-disclosure agreement with Stormy Daniels. NDAs are very common. They're used by media companies. They're used by major for-profit companies. They're used even in private agencies. And there are even individuals who will sign an NDA when they go to work for somebody, saying, if I go to work for you and I learn certain things, I'm not going to disclose those to anyone. They are not uncommon at all. So did Donald Trump pay for an NDA to silence Stormy Daniels? Yes. Did he have an affair with her? I don't know. I couldn't tell you. Do I think he did? No, I don't think he's that stupid. Did he want her to shut up? Yes, he did. Would he have wanted her to shut up whether he was running for office or not? I think the answer to that is yes, which is why NDAs are not all that uncommon. Well, why don't we hear about more of them? Because that's the whole nature of a non-disclosure agreement, is that if you sign it and you take the money, then you don't talk about it. So in many of the celebrities out there who have ever had somebody working for them as a housekeeper, as a driver, as a personal assistant, they get those people to sign NDAs, and they pay for that. Well, here's what Donald Trump is saying. So those are the felony convictions of Donald Trump, that they were allegedly improperly recorded in his business records, but the statute of limitations had already run out on that, so they tried to do it as a federal prosecution, even though the guy doing it was not a federal prosecutor, Alvin Bragg, the DA of Manhattan. So what does Trump say now? He says that criminal prosecutors should charge Barack Obama and other Democrats. I'd love to see Joe Biden be one of those and not be able to use the old excuse that, well, he's an old man and he'll look pathetic in court and those kinds of things. Tell you what, if you did the crime, you should do the time. And should Barack Obama be accused as well? I just want to tell you that Americans should be very, very concerned if we now have a country where once people take power, that the Democrats especially will say, we're going to use the power we have, which is supposed to be used to serve the needs of the American people. We're going to use it to maintain our power. We will smear anybody who comes up against us. And that's what they've tried to do with Donald Trump. Well, now it sounds like the shoe is on the other foot. The president referenced the memo from Tulsi Gabbard. He said, based on what I read, and I read pretty much what you read, it would be President Obama. He started it. President Biden, Comey, Clapper, and others who are involved. Because what did all the investigations find? They found there was no Russian interference in that way through Donald Trump. There may have been some efforts on Facebook, but other than that, they simply wanted an excuse to go after Donald Trump. Well, if Barack Obama knew about it, then I'll tell you what, he should face indictment like anybody else who commits that kind of crime. Let's go to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. We're close to the break. What's on your mind?
My mind is this. He was talking about the 16-year-old that's going to be probably given a life sentence, but basically going to be given a get out of jail free card.
Yep.
Even though he did a crime as a minor. My question is, you know, the week that they had the big drug bust in Salem, and that same Thursday about 7 weeks ago, that kid got stabbed in the cue ball.
Yep.
It's funny, they won't reveal that name. Is this kid the same one that stabbed the kid?
No, it's not. This is a guy who showed up at a birthday party 2 years ago. He murdered one young man. He very seriously injured a young woman. She survived. The other young man died. And all the headlines have been saying he got life in prison. And what he actually got was 15 years until his first parole hearing. And when he served half of his sentence, he'll be allowed to walk out of prison free and clear. And yet the headlines coming out of the major media in Portland say he got life in prison. And that is a big fat lie. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest
Larson Show. Be told, Lars has welcomed naysayers for 27 years, but occasionally...
Who is this person who speaks to me as though I needed his advice?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'm curious about what's going on between Syria and Israel and the United Arab Emirates playing kind of an interesting role as the back channel for talks between those two countries. So I invited Abdullah Hayek on, who's a Middle East analyst and a Young Voices fellow. Abdullah, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Lars. It's great to be here.
So tell me what we should know about what's going on in these talks and what needs to be resolved, and why is the UAE playing the lead role?
Well, right now there aren't any talks. With the events happening in Suwaida and Syria over the past week and a half, this killed the talks that you mentioned that started in early June. The UAE aspiring for influence in another country in the region to compete with the Iranians and the Turks believe that since it, a Gulf country that has relations with Israel, would gain on the long term to mediate a peace talk between Israel and Syria. And the talks were going through positively, with many reports both in Israel and the Arab world reporting that there is progress. But unfortunately, with the eruption of sectarian violence in Suwayda between the Druze and the Bedouins, and Israel intervening and escalating until it struck Damascus itself, the talks have unfortunately fallen through.
So were they deliberately disrupted, do you think, that some, not Israel necessarily, but maybe Israel? I assume Israel wanted the talks to go forward, but the others that raised the level or the temperature of the sectarian violence, did they do that to stop the peace talks from happening?
I think there's fault on both sides. Israel willing and ready to engage in talks with Damascus on the notion that it abandons extremism, it has a good tight leash on the rogue elements within the country, and that, you know, there can be a negotiation regarding the Golan Heights, recognition, diplomatic relations. But with the evident weak control that the current Syrian government has over its military, where we've seen these violent extremist fundamentalist elements roam freely and obviously operate without command from Damascus itself, it gave Israel the impression that, oh, well, maybe it's a bit too early to engage in talks with such a government that has still fundamentalist elements within it. Maybe I should just attend to my short-term interests and make sure that those fundamentalist elements don't expand to my border. I think that Israel is still willing to engage in talks with Syria, just not right now.
Okay, does Syria have the ability to bring all those elements under control, or is that simply something that's not going to happen? Because I would imagine there are players in that region who don't want a peace agreement between Syria and Israel, because if you get that, then there's no longer a way to contest what it is you want as your long-term goal, which may in fact be the elimination of the state of Israel.
Well, it's very hard to tell, because the current Syrian government is not just any Syrian government. It's the rebirth of Syria as a whole. It has abandoned the traditional norms and institutions of the traditional Syrian state adopted since the 40s. It is basically a phoenix rising from the ashes of a new country.
Right.
So how it's going to navigate through all that havoc and chaos, and how it's going to identify itself, its policies internally, its foreign policy, its relationships with its neighbors, it all plays a role. And I think the major factor that's worrying all of its neighbors, Israel included, is whether it's going to be able to control and contain those elements that are fundamentalists, many of whom, by the way, are foreign recruits who were flooding into Syria during the civil war over the past decade. And they still maintain that fundamentalist philosophy. So is Syria willing to put a lid on that and move forward and integrate with the rest of the region? It's way too early to determine that.
Are those foreign elements being pushed in by Iran? Is this another Iran proxy situation where Iran No. Go ahead.
In fact, actually, these elements fought Iran, but they were on the fundamentalist Sunni side. Iran had numerous fundamentalists. Exactly. Iran is Shiite. But Iran fought these, and, you know, Iran backed the Assad regime. And to prop up the Assad regime, the Syrian government back then, they flooded in fundamentalist Shiite recruits. But those Sunni fundamentalist recruits prevailed in December when they ousted Assad and the rest of those Shiite fundamentalists. So it's fundamentalist versus one of them which happened to win, you know.
Yeah, and so how do you end up resolving that with, you know, Syria's main government being at odds with these fundamentalists that are running around their country and getting in the way of getting anything resolved with your neighbors? How do you bring that to a halt?
I think the first step is diplomacy. I think dialogue and communication channels with the government in Damascus have to be open and, you know, continuing. But it has to be firm and strict and disciplined in the sense that, you know, sanctions relief, the business deals, reconstruction, all of that can't come unless concessions are made on your part to make sure that those elements are either de-radicalized or eliminated from the governance process of Syria. You can't normalize your new country with those views being present in the process of the new Syria. No one is going to accept that. So I think the Western world, the United States, Europe, the Arab world, Turkey, need to have a very firm stance, a unified stance, that makes sure that Syria follows the directions that it needs to become a better player on the international community.
I mean, because that means everybody else who lives in Syria is very much being hurt by this ongoing dispute that's going on. Does that matter to the fundamentalists at all?
I mean, that's the problem with fundamentalism. Can you really eliminate it? Can you really change it? It's just something that's so hard to tackle because a fundamentalist is not ignorant. He's well known of what the scenario is, what the situation is. He has just developed that world view point, and it wants to continue adopting that and making sure that the narrative is his narrative. So ignorance can be changed, but these guys are not ignorant. They are very well aware of what they need to do and what they need to continue with.
Well, so and their influence comes from the trouble they're making. The minute they stop making trouble, don't they lose relevance to a certain extent?
Well, the only way you can stop making trouble with that is, you know, military intervention and more airstrikes. And, you know, with the backlash that the Trump administration, you know, received for only striking the nuclear strikes, I don't think that, you know, any U.S. intervention or a renewal of hostilities in Syria would better serve not only the Trump administration, but, you know, the region as a whole.
Well, how about Israel? I mean, is Israel in a position to say, hey, Damascus, if you're having problems with these people, we can take care of them. We've got the tools.
Well, logistically speaking, Israel has been, you know, doing a pretty remarkable job by maintaining and surviving a war with seven fronts. You know, since the onset of October 7th, Israel has been fighting along seven fronts in Gaza and the West Bank, in Syria, Lebanon, Iraq, Yemen, and Iran. So obviously Israel has the operational capacity, the weapons, the ammunition, the, you know, the war fatigue doesn't seem to be in Israel's dictionary right now. But, you know, Israel has a cost to that. Its reputation, its position in the world, it's being closely associated as being a warmonger. Okay. We're seeing a very increasing voice within the conservative movement in the United States. You know, Tucker Carlson, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Thomas Massie, Candace Owens, Dave Smith, all of these influential voices in the conservative movement have become slowly, you know, some of them have been critical, but most of them have been not as supportive of Israel as the conservative audience in the United States has been used to.
Abdullah, thank you very much. That's Abdullah Hayek from the Young Voices Group and a Middle East analyst. Thank you, sir. If you're a landlord.
New plan of action. Just mug all the Dems.
I got a job like 5 weeks ago walking home in New York City. And when I woke up, I genuinely felt like a different person. Because I was on the floor, I was bleeding, I was concussed, and I was 100% Republican.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Tuesday live on the Radio Northwest Network. And, of course, we serve the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk on a daily basis. Today's Ex-Bull, should any state require a boat permit for a paddleboard or two inner tubes that are lashed together? Starting next year, the law on permits. I mean, Tina and I have owned a boat before. We don't own a boat today, not even a gigantic boat. I've had some friends who've had big boats, but you have to have a permit on a boat license or a boat permit from the State Marine Board. If you have a boat longer than 10 feet, if you have a boat that has a motor on it, then you have to have a permit. Well, guess what? Starting next year, watercraft less than 10 feet long, watercraft without engines, will have to have a permit from the state. The State Marine Board says we've got to raise more money for boat stations and to help keep waterways free of invasive species. In other words, you've got a bunch of state employees whose paychecks have to be funded. Marine Board spokesperson Ashley Massey says the funding will help step up the inspection program and decontamination efforts to make sure that boats are not bringing non-native species into local waters. Well, I guess that's all well and good, depending on how you look at it. But can you imagine telling a kid, I guess kids under 14 are exempt as long as they're on a boat that is less than 10 feet in length. So the kid who's 13 years old, who's in a kayak, does not have to have a permit. But as soon as the kid turns 14 years old or older, or as soon as he gets a kayak that's 10 or 11 feet long, then he has to go out and get a permit. Should any state require a boat permit for a paddleboard? Literally, you'd have to have a permit for a paddleboard or two inner tubes that are lashed together. I think that's absolutely stupid. And by the way, it does make me want to mention this because I've been trying to bust this myth for a while. There's a very funny site called This Oregon Life. It's a parody or satire site. And on that site, I think they were inspired by the State Marine Board. They literally said, they ran what looked like a news story. It was not. It was a piece of satire, and adults should be able to tell the difference. And it said that Tina Kotek was going to impose a fine if you splashed your feet or splashed your hands in the rivers or the waters of the state of Oregon. Now, it was a parody, folks. It was to be funny. But a lot of people took it seriously. They also have probably reasonably concluded that maybe Tina Kotek, governor of Oregon, would actually do something so colossally stupid. But that is a fake story. It's a satire. It's not true. It is fiction. This one, though, is true. Requiring boat permits for anything that is less than 10 feet long, if the kid on it is 14 years of age or older than 14, you're going to have a boat permit for a kayak, for a paddleboard, for a raft, for a stand-up paddleboard. You have to buy a permit. I don't think any state should require that. And when they say boat stations, I assume they mean things like boat pump-out facilities where, you know, when you use a toilet or a head on board a boat, sailboat or powerboat, you occasionally have to pump it out. Those are paid for by those state marine board permits. The problem is they're saying we want you to pay the salaries of people who bring boats into the state to keep them free of invasive species. So the kid who's on a 10 or 9-foot paddleboard is going to pay for the cost of having full-blown boats on trailers that are being brought into the state or transported through the state to make sure invasive species don't spread. If that makes sense to any of you, please call and explain it to me, because I don't think it makes any sense whatsoever. But this is the change they're requiring. Should any state require a boat permit for a paddleboard or two inner tubes lashed together? Today's X poll can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com, and brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Now, yesterday, we asked, should the government only use English in all public services? We'll get to that in just a moment. I'm going to grab this call from Dave. Hey, Dave, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Lars, how does this state want to harass the people going out in kayaks and paddle boards? In the meantime, you've got up and down the Willamette these, let's call them pirate boats,
homeless,
stolen watercraft, junky watercraft, anchored, you know, X amount of feet to the shore, so they go under maritime laws, letting their wastewater drain right into Columbia.
Yep.
Stealing anything valuable off of the people that have shore property, whether it's a floating home or a shore property. And these people, there's just zero enforcement on it. And
yep, what are they going to do? True.
They're going to harass people that want to float down the river in an inner tube? It's just goes to the insanity of this state government.
Hey, Dave, let me throw you a scenario that I think is realistic. Imagine a family comes to Oregon from Washington or California or any other state, and they said, we're going to go on vacation in Oregon, and the kids say, can we bring our paddle boards with? Yeah, Dad's going to bring his kayak. The kids are going to bring their paddle board. They show up in Oregon. they go out, and it's a, you know, it's a 15-year-old kid on a paddleboard, and all of a sudden he gets pulled over by the sheriff's patrol, who says, I'm going to write you a ticket because you don't have a state Marine Board permit on your 9-foot or 10-foot paddleboard. Can you imagine that family's reaction when they leave Oregon and say, we're never coming back, and we're going to post on social media, we're going to tell all our friends they're requiring even kids to have permits on their paddleboards. That's crazy.
The Lars Larson Show.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
So the only people that are crying are the mediocre white boys.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network, and I think you know the story. You've got the states of Oregon and Washington, two of the most expensive places to live in the United States when it comes to taxes. Some of the most expensive places to live. I mean, outside of the real extremes like San Francisco and New York, Oregon and Washington have houses that are horribly expensive. And you've got taxes that are horribly expensive. And yet in both states, you've got the state of Oregon saying, we are billions of dollars short of being able to balance our state budget. State of Washington actually imposed a record size tax increase and then immediately announced, and we're short of cash. But meanwhile, right next door in Idaho, an entirely different story. So I thought I'd bring on Jason Mercier, who's Vice President and Director of Research at the Mountain States Policy Center. Jason, welcome back to the program.
Lars, great to be with you.
So you've got Oregon saying we're billions short. We won't even be able to plow snow in the wintertime. You got Washington State saying we've just raised taxes a record amount, and we're still hundreds of millions of dollars short of our state budget. Even though it's a very expensive place to live, even though the average person makes more money here than they do in many parts of America, what's happening in Idaho by contrast?
Yeah, the nice thing about looking at a budget balance sheet, where you're looking at how much they're spending, how much they're collecting, and how much in reserves, is you can kind of discount all those regional cost factors, the different prices, and just have an apples-to-apples comparison between states. And when you look at the balance sheet of Washington State and you compare it with Idaho, you can see why there's a lot of envy for what's happening in the gem state, because unlike Washington, which you mentioned, record tax increases, if the budget is already upside down, Idaho enacted record tax cuts this year, provided more money back to people in the state, and their balance sheet looks really good. You're talking about having almost 22% in reserves, and when you're looking at some of the economic headwinds that we're facing as a nation right now, that's a really great position to be in.
Well, especially because ODOT, for example, because the governor of Oregon just announced there will be a special session, although it sounds like she doesn't have a deal cut yet, because the special session is happening at the end of next month. In fact, it looks like it's leading right into Labor Day weekend, which might be a great way for a politician to camouflage what's going on. And she's saying, we're so short of money at ODOT, we can't even plow the roads, we can't do all these other things. And you say, but you have billions of dollars. Yeah, but it's all committed to other projects, and we're not allowed to move the money around. You've got Idaho there with an unrestricted general fund reserve of $880 million. So if one of their departments ran into a real financial roadblock, they'd have the money to say, okay, pay for what needs to be done, we'll work it out, right?
Yeah, exactly. So when you're looking at the unrestricted, that's what you're going to call your ending fund balance, it's 6%. In contrast, Washington's is 0.04%. That just shows you the lack of fiscal discipline you're seeing in the Evergreen State versus the Gem State. And, you know, beyond just the amount of reserves, Washington, again, record tax increase, Idaho, record tax cut. I think you're seeing the proof is in the pudding that when you have fiscally conservative governance, you have a sustainable budget, you can provide tax relief, and you're well positioned for any economic headwinds.
And yet, the states of Oregon and Washington, I mean, Oregon has, you know, a small number of larger companies like Nike. You've got Washington State that has Microsoft, Amazon to some extent, even though Bezos has moved out of the state. But you've still got some major players there. And yet, despite all of that, Oregon is like that guy or gal who earns a paycheck, and by the 30th of the month, every dime is gone from his checking account, and he's operating on whatever's left in the cupboard, you know, until his next paycheck shows up. Idaho is sitting there saying, no, we take in more money than we spend, and we spend it sensibly. How do we get the states of Oregon and Washington to follow that same kind of model?
Well, unless they're going to want to keep seeing those moving vans heading across the state border to Idaho, they're going to have to start appreciating and respecting their business community. And I think that, you know, in Oregon, you had that ballot measure last year, which was going to be just a massive corporate tax increase. And you even had the governor, the Democrats come out and say, all right, we can't go this far. They all campaigned against that ballot measure, which failed. Unfortunately, in Washington, you're still seeing them pursuing tax increases. And, you know, you would think the reaction would be after having just done this massive tax increase that maybe it's time to cut spending, but you're already hearing that they're going to come back even with more tax proposals next year. So at some point, your business community is just going to say enough, and you're going to keep seeing that growth continuing in Idaho.
Okay, and how did they end up getting this? I mean, because they must have had a legislature and a governor that were all on board for the whole package. Otherwise, this would not have happened.
Yeah, every single year for the past 6 years, you've seen the strategy be, if we've got more money coming in than we need, we're going to return it back to the taxpayers. So you've seen tax relief every single year, and that puts more discipline on your budget. Unfortunately, in Washington, once the Supreme Court overturned the tax restrictions the voters had repeatedly approved, the response every single year in Washington has been to increase taxes. So until you change how you're voting in the Evergreen State, I think you're unfortunately going to get the same policies.
Hey, Jason, thanks very much. We appreciate your time.
Great. Thank you, Lars.
That is Jason Mercier from the Mountain States Policy Center. Let me go to a naysayer, and that's Mike. Hey, Mike, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What do you and I disagree about?
Lars, I'm not a naysayer. I just don't agree that we should be selling whole logs and shipping them to China.
Why not? Okay, tell me why not.
Because they are burying those logs in the water and saving them, and they're going to turn around and sell them back to us for 1,000 times what they're paying for.
How are they going to sell stuff for 1,000 times when we have a country full of trees?
Lars, there's been.
I'm not trying to be funny. It's a serious question. If you said, well, they're going to stockpile all that stuff, and then they're going to turn around and ask a country with 200 million acres of trees, and that's just the federal lands, we'd like to sell you some trees. Have you ever tried to sell firewood to a guy who owns 1,000 acres of forest?
They don't own any trees, Lars. That's the problem.
I understand that, but when they buy trees from us and they hold them for their own use, and we grow more of them as fast, actually faster, than we sell them to them, it's the ultimate renewable resource. Why would you not want to just sell them what they want?
Well, recently, SD&S Lumber had to close.
That's because of federal limits, largely because of federal and state limits on logging here. And why do you think the private landowners are selling their logs to anybody else on the planet who wants to buy them? Because they're offering the best price. Do you know how you could bring that price down? Allow more logging on federal and state lands, and then the price will come down. But for right now, you'd go to a private timber owner and say, you can't sell your logs. Well, why not? Well, because we're going to tell you can't. Can you imagine telling a wheat grower, you're not allowed to sell your wheat? Well, why not? We want you to keep it here and make bread out of it. Well, there's already enough in America. Can we sell it to anybody else? We'll grow more next year. Why would you not want to do that with the ultimate renewable resource?
I don't mind that happening, except for we've lost all of our timber industry and sawmills and our processing.
Because of the federal laws that make it hard to get any kind of steady supply out of the state and federal lands. I'm not going to go molest the private landowners for that. We got to change the laws. Mike, thanks for the call.
Welcome to the market.
If the winner...
Did you know Lars has a face for radio?
He's hideous!
Wanna see? Follow him on Instagram at The Lars Larson Show.
All these Democrats say, you have to talk about and realize that people are really upset about illegal immigration. F*** you.
Yeah, that's Hunter Biden. Yeah, the coked-up son of former President Joe Biden, who wasn't really president the last 4 years because somebody else was running his auto pen. But Hunter Biden emerged from hiding. You know, he has that pardon, so now he doesn't have to worry about being indicted. But he sat down to do an interview, and it was an amazing thing to watch because he basically is simply saying all those Democrats who say we got to deal with this illegal alien problem because Americans are very concerned about it. Apparently, Hunter Biden may be the only person in the Democrat Party who's actually paying attention to what Americans actually care about. I want to share a couple of other things from that. But first, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you and a real pleasure to watch this guy. This Hunter Biden, he is a piece of work. But let me get into that in just a moment. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every single day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can answer our X poll. You'll find the question every day, brand new one, at Lars Larson Show on X. You'll also find the question on my website at LarsLarson.com. Let me get back to Hunter Biden. I mean, this guy is such a piece of work. He acted as the bag man for the Biden crime family. So he'd go to places like Ukraine, sit on a board of directors that he was thoroughly unqualified for by all accounts. He knew nothing about Ukraine. He didn't speak the language. He didn't know anything that you could tell about the natural gas business. But apparently they thought he was worth $1 million a year to sit on their board of directors. In a typical big American company, you know, a name brand company, when they have a board of directors, they might pay their board members a couple of $100,000 a year plus their expenses. Why was Hunter Biden getting $1 million a year out of his Burisma, the natural gas company in Ukraine? Because it gave the Ukrainians a direct line in to Vice President Joe Biden, and I think they anticipated, and it'll give us a line into whatever Joe does next. That's what was going on there. So Hunter Biden goes out, he cavorts with prostitutes, he snorts cocaine, he buys guns illegally, he gets a presidential pardon for all of that. At one point, he even took the gun that he bought illegally because he was a drug addict by his own account at the time he bought the gun. And then his wife or girlfriend, I can't remember which, decided to get rid of the gun. So she threw it in a trash can that was right outside a local school. And then the Secret Service had to go in and retrieve the gun, even though Hunter Biden was not being protected at that point by the Secret Service, but apparently they did a solid for the Biden crime family. So after all of this and all the videos of Hunter Biden with prostitutes, because apparently he liked to shoot videos of himself with prostitutes while he was high on drugs, now all of a sudden Hunter Biden is concerned about making sure that we have enough illegal aliens to do that kind of job. And the soundbite.
How do you think your hotel room gets cleaned? How do you think you have food on your f***ing table? Who do you think washes your dishes? Who do you think does your f***ing garden? Who do you think is here by the f***ing sheer f***ing just grit and will that they figured out a way to get here because they thought that they could give themselves and their family a better chance?
Yeah, a better chance. So in other words, a criminal. And Hunter Biden is a criminal. He may have a pardon, but he was found guilty of tax crimes, gun crimes, and I'm sure he committed many more crimes than the ones that he was actually prosecuted for. But as we know, he's not going to be prosecuted anymore. He's worried that, oh, we've got to let these people who are breaking the law come into our country because somebody has to clean up Hunter Biden's hotel room after he and the prostitute and the cocaine have done what they are naturally inclined to do. This guy is about as disgusting as the day is long. And then he talks about Donald Trump, but without actually mentioning the man's name.
And he's somehow convinced all of us that these people are criminals?
Yeah, those people are the criminals. So once again, just like back in the mid-1800s, Democrats like Hunter Biden are concerned about making sure that they have slaves back in the 1800s, illegal aliens today, who are going to go out and pick their crops and clean their hotel rooms and serve their meals and do all the rest of that. Except that Hunter Biden doesn't really see them as criminals. He sees white men as the enemy in America.
White men in America are 45 more times likely to commit a f***ing violent crime than an immigrant. And the media says, well, you got David Axelrod and, you know, Rahm f***ing Emanuel. So f***ing smart Rahm Emanuel. And so we got to understand that these people are really mad. And these, we got to appeal to these white voters. Rahm, the only people that f***ing appealed to those f***ing white voters was Joe Biden at 81 years old. And he got 81 million votes. And he did because not because he appeased their Trumpian sense, but because he challenged it.
Yeah, because he challenged it. And that and his party cheated on his behalf in that election. We know how that went down. But consider this. Do you know why Hunter Biden, who is a lawyer by training, I'm not sure he's able to practice law because of his little criminal problems. Maybe he is, maybe he's not. But do you know why he's able to make that comparison, saying white men commit more, white American men commit more crimes than immigrants? This is because of a trick. And I want to warn you about this trick. What the Democrats like to do is they like to take all the very law-abiding green card holder legitimate immigrants to America and take their statistics and mix them in with the illegal aliens. And if you got the impression that, well, what about Trende Aragua? What about all the rapes and the murders and the other crimes committed by illegal aliens? Well, they mix those numbers in with the numbers of legal immigrants to America. And why are legal immigrants so law-abiding? Because if you have a green card and a chance to become an American citizen and you commit a crime, a serious crime, you're going to be deported. You're going to lose your green card and you will likely never be able to try it again. So he mixes those two statistics together. And then Hunter Biden talks about values, believe it or not.
But these guys think that we need to run away from all values in order for us to lead. I say, fuck you. How are we getting those people back from fucking El Salvador? Because I'll tell you what, if I became president in 2 years from now, or 4 years from now, or 3 years from now, I would pick up the phone and call the fucking president of El Salvador and say, you either fucking send them back or I'm going to fucking invade. It's a fucking crime what they're doing. He's a fucking dictator thug.
Yeah, and you thought that Kilmar Abrego Garcia, the criminal who got deported and sent to an El Salvadorian prison before he was dragged back to America to face human trafficking charges, you thought he was the new face of the Democrat Party? My argument would be that Hunter Biden, son of the former sort of president of the United States, when somebody else wasn't running the auto pen, that Hunter Biden is the new face of the Democrat Party. Basically, just blank this and blank that. The guy has a foul mouth that will not quit. Apparently, he seems to think that he's more persuasive in these arguments when he's throwing F-bombs around. The fact that he appears to have no regard for Americans, no regard for following the law, and who would? If you're Hunter Biden and you've been able to violate some of the most serious laws in the United States, tax laws and gun laws, and you got away with it, and you got a presidential pardon for all crimes in the past 10 years, then why wouldn't you think, well, why do I need to worry about following the law? Why should America worry about following the law? If this guy is the new face of the Democrat Party, then I'm going to celebrate next year's midterm elections ahead. And by the way, the fact that Hunter Biden can't even figure out when the next presidential election is, I might suggest that maybe he's back on that white to Bolivian marching powder again. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Sometimes the truth is awkward.
You know what the Muslims call the Jews in the Quran? The children of Israel. Well, this is awkward.
Now, more truth from Lars Larson.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. We'll do that in just a moment, but I want to talk about something that may take you back a bit. This year is the 30th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. I remember covering it at the time. I was in Oklahoma City, of course, but covering the story at a distance, and then the search for the person involved, Tim McVeigh, except that there may be more to the story than just that. Margaret Roberts joins me now, and this may be another black eye for the FBI. She is the author. She's both an investigative journalist and the author of a book called Blowback, The Untold Story of the FBI and the Oklahoma City Bombing. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Lars. Great to be with you.
And by the way, if I misstate any...
On publication day.
On publication
which
day.
Which is exciting.
Well, congratulations on that, because the actual date this year was April the 19th. Would you mind telling my audience, remind them of what happened on that horrible day?
Sure. I know some of them may not remember it, but all of them, or most of them, have probably heard of it, because the Oklahoma City bombing still stands as the deadliest domestic terror attack in America. On a Wednesday morning in the heartland, a federal nine stories tall was blown to bits by a bomb. It was 9 in the morning, everybody was going to work, and it was just a devastating shock. 168 people, men, women, children, a lot of, 15 little children in the daycare center, 168 in all died that day, and hundreds more, Lars, were injured, as you remember covering it, I'm sure.
I do. I had some friends who were actually among the first responders who came to that scene, and it was horrific. So where, if people say, but they caught the guy, they caught Tim McVeigh, and they arrested him pretty quickly, and there was allegedly a John Doe number 2, except there may be more to the story than that, and it wasn't just Tim McVeigh. Tell them why your investigative reporting has dredged that up.
Well, absolutely. My book investigates this, really, what is really one of the greatest true crime mysteries of all time, which is this other man who rode in the bomb truck with Timothy McVeigh as he delivered and detonated that bomb. And the other man was never identified. He was known, as Lars just said, only as John Doe 2. But he vanished into thin air, and my investigation chases that mystery, because he was quickly dismissed as the imaginings of eyewitnesses, but he wasn't imagined. He was real, and 24 eyewitnesses, ordinary people, saw him that morning. Top journalists reported that the FBI had surveillance videotape of him. A grand juror soon went public and said federal prosecutors were rigging the grand jury and hiding the identity of John Doe 2. So there was lots of evidence that John Doe 2 did exist. And in chasing that clue, I found people, sources, that began to unfold a very different picture from what the American public was told about that crime.
I'm talking to the former news director of America's Most Wanted. She is Margaret Roberts, and as she said, publication day for a brand new book called Blowback, The Untold Story of the FBI and the Oklahoma City Bombing. So explain to my audience, what do you believe was actually going on there, and why would the FBI so quickly say 24 eyewitnesses who saw a second man, they were mistaken, they imagined it, it didn't happen that way? What do you think really happened?
Well, it's a great question, and of course it was a 20-year odyssey to finally come to some concrete evidence. Well, accumulate concrete evidence, let's say, about what really happened. This was not a crime of lone wolf terror, as the American public was told. We were misled by the government, by the prosecutors who told this story to the jury, by journalists who turned a blind eye instead of asking tough questions. And at the end of my journey, what comes out is that this was a federal infiltration program targeting white supremacists, targeting extremists, that went awry. And Timothy McVeigh was certainly involved in this crime, but not the mastermind. And so what eventually happened was, I don't know how this sting operation went sideways, tragically so, but the last 30 years has been about covering up what really happened there.
Yeah, because this is this would be another black eye for the FBI. And I've told my audience there was a time when I had great respect for the agency. I don't so much anymore, especially because of things like McVeigh, because of things like D.B. Cooper, because of the misses that they constantly have. And I've always, I mean, there's been a theory that sometimes the FBI likes to, you know, publicize when they have a miss, so they end up being, you know, perceived as the Keystone Cops. But that's a little bit much to imagine, that they would say, let's make everybody think that we're just completely clueless, and that way it'll be easier for us to actually find the bad guys and get them in custody. Except they keep seeming to screw up over and over again. And in the last few years, even this week, what was the role they played in the Russia collusion hoax? But I don't want to take us too far astray. Is there a way to get after John Doe number two and see that he's prosecuted and perhaps even executed like McVeigh was?
Well, absolutely. And at the middle, Lars, at the middle of my investigation is a remarkable man, an attorney in Salt Lake City named Jesse Trinidou. His work over the past 30 years has been driven by the demons of what happened to his brother, who was a prisoner. Jesse's a lawyer. His brother was a prisoner in 1995 in Oklahoma City, and he was tortured and murdered 4 months after the Oklahoma City bombing. And without spoiling and hoping that your readers will want to know
that.
More, he pursued this case with all his legal skills. And the bottom line is the surveillance videotapes that the FBI collected 30 years ago and that the American public has never seen will show who got out of the truck with Timothy McVeigh. And if that person was a federal operative or informant, that would also identify him or her. And Jesse has led the battle in federal court in a landmark Freedom of Information Act lawsuit that continues to this day. So that would be the best way to identify John Doe 2.
Margaret, thank you very much. That's Margaret Roberts. She's an investigative journalist, formerly with America's Most Wanted, the author most recently of Blowback, the untold story of the FBI and the Oklahoma City bombing. Time to get your calls. And Margaret, thank you very much. 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network. I'll get to your phone calls and emails coming up next.
Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk. But fair warning, if you're listening to this show, you're likely on the FBI's most wanted list. Welcome to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program on the Radio Northwest Network. And this segment of the show brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists, Oregon Medical Centers. And our X poll today, and this seems so crazy, you almost can't imagine it. Should any state require a boat permit for a paddleboard or a kayak or some kind of watercraft less than 10 feet long with no motor? Even two inner tubes lashed together. Starting next law, the law will expand to include watercraft less than 10 feet long. That means kayakers, rafters, even stand-up paddleboarders must buy a state permit. Even though all the money, they say, is going to go for revenue for boat stations. I don't know how many paddleboarders need a boat station or a pump out or a ramp to be able to put their paddleboard in the water. And they certainly aren't involved in that question of keeping the waterways free of invasive species. So they're going to pick people off. And as I told you, or I've mentioned before, can you imagine the scenario where a family comes happily to the Pacific Northwest to vacation, and they spend some time in Oregon, and they decide the kids want to throw their paddle boards in the water, and they do, and then the sheriff rolls up and writes them a ticket for some amount of money saying you didn't have the official permit that allowed you to put that paddle board in the water. Can you imagine what that is going to do? And then I got this note from Don Krecklau. He said, Lars, I'll make it short. So why are they charging people to get on the water, but they don't put a permit on bicycles or electric bikes or scooters? They need to, and call it a road access permit, kind of like the water access permit. Maybe they could fix the roads a bit better. That's my rant. First timer, signed Don. And now we'll go to Ron in Tacoma. Hey, Ron. Oh, and if you want to join us, it's 866-439-5277. Ron, what's on your mind?
Well, what's on my mind is the alphabet soup agencies, the CIA, the FBI, just kind of what you were talking about earlier. I don't see the point. I want them all defunded, and I'm going to tell you why. They don't do anything. Even when they say that they're investigating, I just heard the other day that they were investigating the whole time before Kennedy was assassinated. So what is the point? I don't know who they report to, but there never seems to be a conclusion. No one ever goes to jail. No, we don't even find out that they were even investigating until after someone's long dead and buried.
True.
What is the point? We got Benghazi, January 6th, the Mar-a-Lago. We could go on here for 20 minutes.
We could.
Stuff off, but nobody knows anything. How will we call them intelligence agencies? How?
We shouldn't. And Ron, I wouldn't mind if they tore all those agencies down. And then if you decide, and I've made the argument, do we need some federal investigatory agency? Probably. But an awful lot of those capabilities that were way outside the reach of local or state police around America are well within their reach. Now, are there occasionally crimes that involve federal laws and you want the federal agency to be involved in prosecuting it? Probably. But do you need an FBI as big as the FBI we have now? I mean, it might have been that there was a time where they would send fingerprints off to the FBI to match them up. These days, an awful lot of that is done by local agencies with much better technological tools. The same thing with other kinds of testing that would have been done by the FBI's crime lab, except that an awful lot of those capabilities are now available at the local area. So thin that agency down, keep it well within its bounds, and simply do not tolerate any use of the FBI or agencies like it in politics, because the FBI is clearly involved in what went on, which Donald Trump is now suggesting might actually lead to the prosecution of Barack Obama. When the FBI knew what was on Hunter Biden's laptop computer, because they had the laptop computer in their possession, and they did nothing with the information, and they allowed the American public to be deceived prior to an election. And I don't know, you've probably heard the same polls that I've cited on this show. And that says if when they went to Democrats after the election in which Joe Biden allegedly won the election in 2020, and they said to them, if you had known that the stuff on the laptop computer did in fact implicate both Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, would you have voted differently? And they had a sizable percentage of Democrats who said they had voted for Biden, but they would not have voted for him had they known that information was true. The FBI played a very political role. If you can't keep that agency out of politics, then maybe the FBI shouldn't exist at all. What do you think, Ron? No, sounds like Ron gave, or his phone gave up, one or the other. But, you know, for all the misses over the years, I can't tell you the Pulse nightclub shooting that the FBI had information on and they missed. The shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High in Parkland, Florida. The FBI and local law enforcement had warnings, explicit warnings, ahead of time. And every time there's some serious issue like that, where people end up hurt or dead, and we find out later, well, the FBI was investigating, well, the FBI got obvious clues, and the FBI didn't do anything with the information, and instead, you had James Comey leading the agency, deciding that he would set up part of Donald Trump's cabinet at the very beginning of Trump's first term as president of the United States, and he admitted that they set up General Mike Flynn. Now, Flynn, in my view, has kind of gone off the deep end on some other issues more recently. But at the time, he was going to serve as the Director of National Intelligence for President Trump. And the FBI said, we got to take this guy out. So they went in and they deceived the vice president and the president. They got Flynn fired. That agency should not exist, as far as I'm concerned. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars.